name is John Tintera, and today I'm speaking with Ken Jack, co-author of the new book, Blue Moon Over Cuba, Aerial Reconnaissance During the Cuban Missile Crisis. Ken, it's great to hear you again.
Good to talk with you too, John.
In your book, you surface the tensions between the Air Force and the Navy regarding who got credit for the low-level missions. The recent edition of the American Legion magazine, in an article on the 50th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis, mentions the U-2 and the Air Force, but leaves out entirely any Navy participation. Why is this an important issue 50 years later to the naval aviation community?
It's an issue because we had the lead role in the reconnaissance missions, and down through the years, and even today, it appears that our role in the Cuban Missile Crisis was never known or reported well. And that bothered aviators for many, many years. In fact, that was Captain Eckers, one of his motivations for writing his memoir, to let people know who did what during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So I tried to deal with that in the book, and to clarify the reasons we were chosen to be the first to fly the missions over, and the role that we played critically in the rest of the missions for the remainder of the 13 days, which were both flown by Marines, Air Force, and Navy. So that's what we try to get straightened out in the book.
We talked a little while ago with Captain Jim Curry, who talked about the Chicago aerial cameras. He mentioned this a couple times, being key to the fact that the Navy was given that lead role. Can you dig in a little bit more for us on what those Chicago aerial cameras were, why they were so innovative, and why it was just the Navy that had them before the Air Force and the Marines?
Yes, in the book, I talk a lot about the technical aspects of getting good pictures from a low-flying speedy jet. And the Chicago aerial camera was brought out after the Photo Crusader was in the fleet, and the original configuration for the RF-8 Crusader was cameras that only had a 2.25 by 2.25 inch format. And that's typical of what you would have in your cameras that you would take pictures of around your family and so forth during those days. And what happened later was they decided that a larger format negative would give more detail for the photo interpreters. So they came up with a 5-inch by 5-inch square format for the film. That was one area that the camera did well in. And also the fact that the camera could recycle very fast. Because when you're flying low and fast, the camera has to take pictures at a very fast rate to get the clarity that Jim was talking about, the image motion compensation, which makes sure you don't get fuzzy pictures because the ground is flowing by so fast underneath the aircraft. So this camera could deal with that very well. And we had the contract with Chicago Aerial. It was basically a Navy R&D effort to get that camera to work well in a fighter jet. And the Air Force was excluded from that effort. And when they found out that our cameras really gave the best results, they wanted them, but they couldn't get any because we had the total supply coming to us. Along the way, the Chief of Naval Operations gave the Air Force a number of cameras out of our supply.
I love it. What a great story. And Jim talked about setting the dials. And can you dig into that a little bit more for us? Is that a matter of aligning the airspeed and the altitude of the jet with the shutter speed of the camera?
Yes, that's the general idea. Not the shutter speed so much, however, but there's several things that we had to get, we had to provide to the photo interpreters. One was overlap from one frame to the next. For any given detail on the ground, we had to have 60% overlap on the next frame shot by the camera. And so that would require what I was talking about before about the recycling rate. And the reason that they needed that overlap was because the photo interpreters look at these photos side by side with a special eyepiece that gives them a pseudo-stereo view of the ground. so they could actually see the images of the, on the ground in three dimensions.
Wow.
And so that was so in order to get all of that to happen correctly, the cameras and the electronics that drive the cameras has to know how high the aircraft is and how fast it's flying. Now, there were two ways to do that in the Crusader, and one was like Jim was saying, that there was a dial, two dials on the side of his in the cockpit that he could dial in his altitude and his speed manually.
Mm-hmm.
And then that information would be transmitted back through the electronics to the camera that then would set the overlaps and the image motion compensation correctly. The other mode was an automatic mode where there was a special other device which could totally ignore what the pilot was putting in on the knobs, and it would actually look at the ground and calculate those parameters by itself. The only reason the pilots didn't like that mode so much is because it tended to have problems, especially if the window for that scanner device got dirty. So, and then, like, for example, our aircraft were flying over the sea so low that they were picking up salt spray. So if salt spray got on the windows, then it might cause that mechanism not to work correctly.
Got it. Fascinating. I want to shift gears a little bit and talk about the culture of the VFP-62. I mean, you remember and you give credit for the high performance of the VFP-62. You know, and this is something that you study in business school. You know, how do you get a highly functional team? What are the attributes of a highly functional team? And it sounds like VFP-62 was one such animal. Tell us about it and tell us what you've learned in your lifetime from having been in that very elite group.
Well, I entered the squadron as a teenager. I read out of photo school. And the first thing that struck me about the culture of the squadron was the leadership that we had. We still had officers and chief and senior petty officers, enlisted people, that still had World War II and Korean War experience. So they were highly mature leaders. That and the officer corps that supervised over it, they tended to give their subordinates as much freedom to experiment and to explore and to improve as possible. And I saw that over and over again when I would return from the carriers on deployment with a VFP-62 detachment and work in the photo maintenance shop in the hangar, that I'd go in and Chief Wally would be there, who was a photographer, but a chief petty officer. He was huddling over a new diode that he was trying to get to make work so that it would efficiently trigger the camera if the light from the flares would go off at night.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, that experimentation was going all the time. I think we're just a group of people that knew that we had a special mission, and we were proud of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Excellent. Talking again some more about your perspective, you were an enlisted man during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and from your point of view, what was it like to work around the Crusader?
It was awesome. It's if you ever go to an air show, watching the Blue Angels or the Thunderbirds from the Air Force, and you see those high performance jets going through their routines, and that you can get a vicarious impression of what it's like to actually work around these jets day in, day out. The aircraft was awesome. It was fast. It looked beautiful. The equipment worked very, very well, and the pilots were great. It was a great opportunity for a young kid entering into the service and to be able to work around all this professionalism and this great equipment. We were very, very proud of it. At the time I went in, we were the fastest jet the Navy had, and so we got a lot of attention.
Who were your bunk mates when you were at sea? Were you bunking up with maintainers and other people who were directly involved with the aviation equipment?
The way it worked was the air group would deploy with the ship. There was a ship's company that was stationed aboard the ship at all times. And in the case of the Forrestal, for example, it was stationed at Norfolk, Virginia. And when the ship would deploy, the air group would join the carrier. The planes would fly out to meet it at sea once we left port. But the air group, the support staff, the crew members, the enlisted staff, would fly to Norfolk, and we'd get on the ship, and then we'd carry all of our equipment onto the carrier, which was a large job. And then we'd have our own sleeping compartments, where we'd stay as a group.
Got it.
The enlisted would sleep together, and then the officers had their own staterooms in the carrier's officer quarters.
Got it. Neat. Speaking of the Forrestal, you were on the Forrestal in the Mediterranean during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Did you know about your home-based squadron's role in the crisis?
We were in the Mediterranean at that time, and we knew that the Cuban crisis was happening because we got the transmission of President Kennedy's announcement about the missiles being installed in Cuba. So we actually heard his address. So we knew the Cuban Missile Crisis was happening, and we did know that our squadron had a role in it. What we didn't know was what was actually happening on the missions. And that may seem a little strange, but there was a super secret requirement for these missions that the Navy really rigorously held in strictly. That if you didn't have a need to know, and we were in the Mediterranean, so we didn't have the need to know, then word did not get transmitted to us about what their actual missions were like.
Right.
In fact, I was just interested in finding out after our book was published from a squadron member who was at Key West working on the planes that were making missions to Cuba, and they didn't know what was happening.
Wow.
They knew that they were flying to Cuba, but they didn't know why or what the mission was, or they never saw the pictures or anything like that.
Gosh.
So the secrecy was so well kept that even the people that were working right at the site sending these aircraft over to Cuba didn't really understand what was happening, and they didn't know the details until our book came out.
Wow. So what's the reaction been like to the release of the book? Have you heard a lot of these kind of stories that you probably wouldn't have heard unless you'd published the book?
Yes, it is very interesting because I wish I had heard some of these. It reawakened a lot of their memories that had been dormant for so many years. When they read the book and they got the details that was coming out from the sources that I had got together and put in the book, they found in their memories things they had forgotten for 50 years.
Wow.
And they started telling me about them, and I documented some of that on my squadron website, VIP62.com, and the Cuban Missile Crisis pages. There's a book review section, and I put some of the stories that my squadron members have been telling me about their memories. Once they read the book, it all seemed to flow back.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, a great little side benefit to, I'm sure, what's been a massive project.
I have one other interesting story I'd like to share with you.
Please, yeah.
Speaking about strange coincidences, Captain Ecker wrote about his World War II experience in the first chapter of the book. And in that chapter, we have a group of photos of Captain Ecker as a young aviator along with his fellow aviators on carriers in the Pacific. One of those photos has a photo of his wingman, Wes Hayes, whose son heard about our book and wrote me an email saying that his dad worked, always remembered Captain Ecker. And so I told him that there's a photo of his dad and Captain Ecker in our book.
Yes.
And so he asked me to send a book to his dad, and I did that. And so his dad is 91 years old, and he's a member of the Greatest Generation. And a strange occurrence where this book will be tying together two old aviators. Unfortunately, Captain Ecker's passed away, an aviator that knew Captain Ecker, and the Blue Moon book brought the two together again.
Gosh, so they had fought together in the Pacific.
Yes.
Fantastic.
In the same squadron, BF-10.
Gosh. Very great story. Great story.
So it's
story.
A kind
I've
of
got
a
chills.
Spine-tingling story
I've got
that happened to me just recently.
I love it.
Yeah, so
I love
it. The book
it.
Is pulling people together that haven't thought about the crisis for 50 years, and I hope as more and more become aware of it, we'll hear more and more of those kind of stories.
I'm sure we will. Ken, thank you so much for your time again today, and let's schedule another one of these. These are really fun.